Slicer Tangents is brought to you by Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit a million order stage and everywhere in between. Sari and Hank, can you name anything that works so well? It's practically magic.
Dragonflies.
Toilets.
What? Yeah, okay. Well, here's one off the top of my head. How about selling with Shopify? Ooh. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and it helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Ooh. Not to mention, it's got award-winning customer support there to help you on your path to success. And those are just a few reasons to love Shopify. But Hank, what does your company, DFTBA, like so much about Shopify?
We've been using Shopify, I think, for over 10 years now, and it really has scaled extremely effectively with us. It is both a huge amount of information at your fingertips, but also in a way that makes it fairly easy to make the decisions you need to make, learn the things you need to learn, and do the things you need to do. It's all in there. And it's one of the great joys of my life is going into the Shopify backend and being like, look at all these people who wanted a thing that I had.
What a rich life you lead indeed.
And if you want to experience great joys like that too, I've got a magic trick for you. Poof. You can now try Shopify for a month for only $1. That's right. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/tangents now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in, and experience the little joys of looking at the back end of a store. shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Abracadabra.
Hello and welcome to SciShow Tangents. It's the lightly competitive knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green, and I'm joined this week, as always, by science expert Sari Riley.
Hello. Ready to be an expert about science.
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hello.
I have a question for the two of you. If you had a country, what would be on the $1 coin? Because there's not going to be a $1 bill that's a ridiculous idea, and there will be no pennies because we're all not monsters. But what's going to be on your $1 coin?
I think I would go very simple. I don't want to like memorialize anyone or anything. Mm-hmm. My problem with coins is when they look too similar. And okay. I just want all of my coins to have a different color. Okay. And maybe different shape.
I like it.
Yeah, that's great.
The $1 coin will just be a circle. Okay. It'll get the standard shape because that feels like a very practical thing. But mm-hmm. then like half a dollar, you'll get a square or something
nice.
Like that.
Square coin.
And that way you'll be able to like look at a pile in your hand and be like, oh, I can count more easily what I have.
Yeah, it's good. I don't know if it would work. I don't know if it would work easily in the coin machines. But hey, this is ending. We're not doing that anymore. We're moving beyond. I'm just going to touch it with my cell phone, or better yet, the microchip that's implanted in my pinky finger, and then get my gumball that way when I'm 5 years old, because that's when you get your microchip. What do you think, Sam? What's on your microchip? I mean, your coin.
For me, the answer is simple. My beautiful wife.
Oh, wow.
Now I'm going to look bad for not saying my partner.
So Rachel's on one side of the coin, and then the other side it's
the big number one to tell you how many dollars it's worth.
Big number one. Yeah. I like that. Every week here on Tangents, we get together to try to one-up amaze and delight each other with science facts while trying to stay on topic. Our panelists are playing for glory, and they're also playing for Hank Bucks, which I'll be awarding as we play. And at the end of every episode, one of them will be crowned the winner. Now, as always, we introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem, this week from Sam Schultz.
Now, what the heck? This isn't right. For though I'm pulling with all my might, into the ground I seem to be sinking. And this whole situation has got me thinking about just how I got into this mess of black sticky goo. And here's my best guess. A long time ago, some creatures all died and rotted away and left this smelly slime. Then it came up through the ground it bled and pulled up here to kill my ass dead. It's a marvel of nature. It's pretty darn neat. If only I weren't sinking down to my teats. But oh well, I guess it's no good complaining. I keep sinking faster the more that I'm straining. Maybe I'll rot and become one with the tar and someone will sink into me. But for now, au revoir.
Okay. Nice. Our topic for the day is sticky things. And Sam went for a tar pit, which is a very sticky thing, mm-hmm. and also does kill things by being sticky.
Well, it used to, I guess. Maybe not anymore.
I don't know. I bet a bird will fly in there every once in a while.
Yeah.
They're dummies. And sticky is an interesting thing. People often ask me about sticky when they're asking me science questions. They're like, how does a bug stick to the ceiling? Which is a very different thing from actual stickiness. And they ask about how, like, how glue works, etc.
So it's not all the same thing. Like the stickiness of of slime is not the stickiness of a bug's foot. Is not tape stickiness.
It does work differently. And sometimes like a bug isn't actually sticky. It's just like hooked on.
Okay.
Just like holding on with its little fingers, basically. But is that stickiness? What is stickiness? It's like it won't let go of a thing. So I guess it's kind of stickiness. Anyway, that's not my job. Sari, what is sticky?
Well, you just set up how hard my job is because I was going to preface it with, I don't know. Like, there are so many stickies. What type of sticky are you talking about?
Okay.
In the bubble that I'm drawing, I also left out hooky things. Like, I am not considering Velcro as sticky.
Right.
So any bugs or objects that work like Velcro with, like, hooks and loops or hooks and, like, crevices, not sticky. But sticky is broken into two chemical words, adhesion and cohesion. So adhesion is the binding force between two different materials. So like tape and the wrapping paper that you're wrapping a present with. But cohesion is the binding force between two similar materials. So like one glue molecule and its neighboring glue molecule.
So I adhere to a cat because I would like to pet the cat, but the cat doesn't really care.
Uh-huh.
Whereas I cohere to my wife because we would both like a hug.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It sounds nice. I hope it's right.
I don't see why not. As the science expert, I say that's okay. There are a lot of people who study stickiness, and it's a lot of like very smart physicists. So I apologize to them in advance because I'm not a very smart physicist. I'm like an average biologist. So I guess like the best way to explain something sticky is something like tape, because that's, I think, what most people, if you thought of something sticky, it would be like glue or tape.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that that works is the glue molecules on the tape are held together by cohesion. So like the sticky side has some sort of like glue or adhesive material. And cohesion is holding those molecules together. So they're all like bunched up. And then when you squish tape onto a surface, the molecules spread out and get into all the little cracks and crevices of that surface. Like you don't often see them with your eyes. And this is why it's hard to tape something to like a very, very smooth surface, because even our glass windows often have little pores in them. And so like the adhesive gluey stuff seeps into those and then adheres to it. And so there are adhesive forces between like the glass molecules or the paper molecules and the glue, so that when you try and peel it off, it's harder to, because there's like that stick. That's my best that is my best explanation of sticky. But then there's different like electrostatic stickiness, which is like electric forces holding things together. Gecko's little feet. Gecko feet work really in a different way. I think they involve some sort of electrostatic attraction, but also like maybe some mechanical adhesion or Van der Waals forces, which are like interatomic forces holding things together. So I don't know. There's a lot of sticky.
There's a lot of sticky. The wild thing is that like, If you're coming at this like, I have a question about science, you can ask a question. It's like, that's very simple and easy. No problems. And like, but like, which ones turn out to be complicated are like make no sense at all. It's like sound, not that complicated, pretty simple, all mechanical, really easy to solve with pretty simple math. Light, No idea. Sorry, can't help with colors. Colors are nope.
At colors, least light seems like it should be complicated because it's from space. So that's understandable. Well,
but like color doesn't seem like it should be complicated. I feel like an F sharp and red should be analogous.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it's like it's a completely different situation. Like there's still, I mean, weirdly enough, there's still like wavelengths and stuff involved. But like, why is one thing red? It's all inside of the atoms.
So then you're saying if someone says, why is sticky? Then there is no way to explain to them why is sticky.
Yeah, why is sticky is complicated, especially because there's not one sticky. And and also, like, is everything a little sticky? Kind of.
Yeah. And we live in a sticky world. Is the Earth sticky because gravity is holding us there? Whoa. That's a force holding us.
I don't like that. I don't want to live on a sticky planet. That's a weird stick. It's kind of sticky, though.
It's kind of, we're not floating off of it.
The weird thing is that it keeps being sticky even if I'm not touching it. I like jump up and it's like, I still stick. Whoa. Welcome to space time. Enjoy your stay forever. Anyway, thank you for helping. Do you know where the word sticky comes from?
Oh, this is like medium interesting to me. less so. But usually when I say something are uninteresting, then one of you asks a question that makes it interesting.
That's a lot of pressure.
So sticky as meaning like adhesive or inclined to stick to it, something else, came about in around 1727. I don't know where the text was. I tried to find it, but 1700s. And that came from the verb stick, which means to pierce or to remain embedded or to be fastened. Uh-huh. So like in the way that you could stick someone with like a spear, you could also, that became like you can stick a piece of paper to a wall.
Whoa.
Right, and those like share the same verb. Yeah. And then stickers, whole separate thing.
What?
Where like in the, like the 1580s, so like before sticky was a word.
What?
Sticker was one who sticks. So if you were like the man with the spear who like poked people, then you'd be a sticker. But then sticker as in the adhesive thing that you can stick on walls is from as early as 1871, but probably not until like the early 1900s when someone named R. Stanton Avery patented the world's first self-adhesive die-cut labeling machine, which are like, instead of having to paste a label before putting it on something, it just came with like the peel off backing that you can then stick to something. So sticker, as we know it, very recent word.
But before it was a fun thing for children, it was a murder man. Anyway, it's time to move on to the quiz portion of our show. This week, I've got a game called This or That for You, and it's about sticky food. Because different kinds of foods are sticky, and it's important to understand the stickiness of food for the consumer. Some people like your food to be more or less sticky. Also for the processing of the food. So for today's game of This or That, I'll be presenting you with a scientific method used to determine the stickiness of foods, followed by two foods that have been tested using that method, and you have to guess which of the two foods is stickier.
Oh, okay.
Our first way that we determine whether or not things are sticky is scientific-ish, but it is just people. There's a bunch of sort of like descriptive ways of measuring stickiness. In 2003, a study of cheeses was published that explored the various properties of cheeses. It was a very long article, but one of the properties was stickiness. They also turned to a panel of 15 people who had been trained for about 10 hours on different techniques to evaluate cheeses. Then those people were given 1.27 centimeter blocks of cheese, and they were told to score them on various properties, including stickiness, which was called chew down adhesiveness, which describes, quote, the degree to which the chewed mass sticks to mouth surfaces.
Okay. So this sounds fun.
There's two cheeses here. There's mozzarella or Monterey Jack. They've both been aged for 38 days. Which has the higher chew down adhesiveness, according to this panel of 15 well-trained, though briefly trained, analysisers?
This feels like a trick question. Because mozzarella is the stickiest of the cheeses.
I'm trying to imagine eating both of them, like biting into both of them, and which gets stuck in my mouth more. And like, of course, mozzarella is on pizza, but like if you just bite into a mozzarella ball, that's not that sticky.
That's a great point. Well, what the heck is Monterey Jack like?
It's like a sandwich cheese, I think. Okay. I think you can be like, I want a slice of Monterey Jack on my sandwich.
That's got a little more tooth to it, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little more toothsome, a word that I learned from Top Chef.
All right, I'm going to make you guys guess. Stop talking. 3, 2, 1.
Monterey Jack.
You are both correct. It is Monterey Jack. I thought we might get you with that because mozzarella is stretchy and that seems like a stickiness thing, but it's a separate thing from stickiness.
Okay.
So just because something can stretch doesn't mean that it's sticky. So yeah, Monterey Jack was a 7 on the scale. It was a 1 to 15 scale. 1 was Parmesan. Munster is a 7. Feta is a 12. And then processed cheese got a full 14. So Jack, Monterey Jack was a 7 and mozzarella was a 5 on that scale.
That reflects my life experience.
That reflects my life experience. This seems correct. Cheese scientists have it right. Next, we have the texturometer, which is not what it's called. It is called the TAXT2. And it's been called the texturometer or the tack meter. It's a device that uses a probe to touch. These people also make a bunch of different things that like squish stuff and like see how flexy it is. It's great. It's just a thing that feels analytically. It basically just pokes stuff for a living. And the texturometer basically just puts like a little probe into the thing and then pulls it out and measures how much it gets pulled back as it's taking the thing out of the thing.
Gross.
And it was originally used for dough stickiness. Oh. And when the two scientists in 1995, they published development of an objective method for dough stickiness. And since then, it seems like these devices that are used in food labs have done very well. So congratulations to those people who figured this out. But which is stickier? We've got dough, and I'm sorry I did not have a bunch of, I wish I could have found a broader category of objects for this, but no, dough or dough that has been prepared with microbial transglutaminase, an enzyme that helps to cross-link gluten.
What kind of question?
The regular dough or cross-linked gluten dough. 3, 2, 1.
The normal dough.
You are both correct. The dough that was prepared with the microbial transglutamase was less sticky, possibly because the matrix held in the water better, and so there was less water around to make the dough sticky.
You want a dough to be not sticky but stretchy, I imagine, right? So
I think you want it to be less sticky. Yeah. When I'm imagining when I'm making dough, I don't want it to be sticking to me. I want it to be stretchy. Annoying.
I've been sourdough bread baking like everyone else on the planet. But it starts out stickier, the less you knead it. And then as you knead it, it gets into a clump. And that's because your mechanical action of it is shifting the molecules around and forming more gluten.
Right.
And so you gluten cloak your bread. There's one step where you pull up the sides around it and it gets less and less sticky the more you knead it because you're forming the gluten strands.
Well, Sari knew that one hands down. You would have bet $10,000 on that.
Yeah, probably. Well, I don't have $10,000. If I could bet into a sink, I'll bet $10,000 and then just win it, then hell yeah.
You're ready to gamble on that, boy. You would have gone on margin. All right. Our last method for measuring stickiness is about powders. Because even powders can be sticky, and that's important because they can stick to each other. They can also stick to packaging. So one way to measure this stickiness is called the sticky point temperature, and that's the temperature at which powders begin to cake together. And that sticky point temperature is measured by sealing a powder in a tube with a device that has blades that stir the powder up, and then the tube is immersed in a water bath, and then the temperature is slowly raised until the blades suddenly need more force to stir, which is because the powder has started caking.
There's some scientists out there doing some wacky shit, huh?
Right? Well, this is all very important. It's wild to think this is all the stuff that is necessary to get us our powdered cheese stuffs. You know, you gotta get that Cheeto dust to the Cheeto factory somehow. Mm-hmm. So, which is stickier? Instant coffee powder or tomato soup powder? 3, two, one, answer.
Coffee.
Tomato soup.
The answer is instant coffee powder. Sticky point temperature goes up with increasing molecular weight, and tomato soup powder has a higher molecular weight than instant coffee powder, making it less sticky. So that means Sam Schultz got 3 points and Sari got two. Congratulations, yes. Sam, going into the fact off with a lead for once. Next up, we're going to take a short break, and then it will be time for the fact off. What? Sorry, was I a little rough on you? A little rough on you there?
Dig in there.
Slash Your Tangents is brought to you by Rocket Money, a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Money is annoying. You have to remember so much stuff, like your bank account password and your PIN number. You got to balance your checkbook, and I don't even know what that means to balance your checkbook. You got to put all your receipts in a folder or something probably too. And who has time for all that? Not me, the old money dummy himself. But if you don't manage your finances, there can be dire consequences. Like maybe, for instance, you pay your utility bill twice, huh?
You know, we all make mistakes. We all move sometimes. My partner and I moved recently. I didn't think to check the old utility accounts, but then I was doing my taxes and going through all the utility bills. And we logged into our old account and I was like, what the heck? There's a couple hundred dollar bill here for an apartment that we don't live in anymore. Mm. What's going on here?
The electric company's just like, thank you very much.
Yeah. And I was just too busy and too tired to figure out that out until mid-February when I was like, oh, shoot. But boy, would it have been easier if we had an app that said, you're paying your utility bill twice.
The unfortunate truth of the matter is important to keep on top of your finances. But the fortunate truth is that Rocket Money exists. Rocket Money gives you a clear view of your expenses, letting you see your spending in one place at a glance. Rocket Money gives you the power to easily track your monthly spending, create custom budgets, and even find and cancel unwanted subscription services, and also potentially utility bills for old apartments you don't live in anymore. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when you use all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use, like subscription services, and stop paying your power bill twice, like I almost did. Thankfully didn't. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your finances the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/tangents. That's rocketmoney.com/tangents. rocketmoney.com/TANGENTS.
Welcome back, everybody. Again, Sam is in the lead, 1 point ahead of Sari, and it's time for the fact off. Our panelists have brought science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind, and after they've presented the facts, I will judge and award them Hank Bucks any way I see fit. And to decide who goes first, I have a trivia question. Modern beekeepers owe much to Ukrainian beekeeper Petro Prokopovich for his invention of the movable frame hive, which allows beekeepers to extract excess honey from the hive. But honeybees aren't just famous for their sticky honey. They are also known for sticking by their queen. And Petro studied this bee swarm behavior and used his knowledge to become the first person to ever model a bee beard by placing the queen on his chin and allowing her hive to swarm on his face.
What a fun man.
Thank you very much, Ukrainian beekeeper. What decade did this first bee beard occur in?
I have no clue. When were people having fun with bees?
This seems could be like a medieval thing almost to me, or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have no other games to play, so you have bees. Yeah.
I mean, I guess the Ukraine had to exist.
Oh, that's true. I don't know when that was, though. I'm going to go with 1880.
Okay, I'm going to go with 19.
Sam is the winner. It was 1830, the first bee beard, which is significantly before I would have assumed. So, Sam, you get to decide who presents first in our fact off.
I'm just going to go first.
Do it.
In the rainforest canopies of Borneo, you'll find ants of all shapes and sizes. One of these is the weaver ant, which build themselves nests of leaves with sticky silk. But weaver ants aren't the sticky ants that I want to talk about today, and instead I would like to talk about a species of ant that weaver ants love to bully, eat, kill in various different ways. Colobopsis explodens are tiny, unassuming ants that have little tiny, almost invisible mandibles that you can't even really see that make them not very good at fighting. Weaver ants are big and they have huge chompers, so they just kind of like walk around picking on sea explodens, and they battle them and eat them and steal their territory. But while sea explodens might have teeny tiny chompers that you can't see, they do have unusually large mandibular glands, which are sort of like salivary glands of insects. And in ants, the fluids that the mandibular glands make are very specialized. Like some of them make alarm pheromones, or some make toxins to make a painful bite. And sea explodens makes a sticky, yellow, toxic goo, but they are not using their mandibles to inject this goo like other ants do. So sea explodens' mandibular gland is so big that it runs through their entire body, including into their big old ant butt, known as their gaster. Okay. So when these ants' like home is being attacked, either by weaver ants or by any other kind of like unfriendly bug, a team of these sea explodens will latch onto the enemy bugs, clench their butts so hard that they, as you may have guessed from the name, explode. And they coat the enemy with sticky mandibular gland secretions, like this yellow goo.
When they explode, how do they feel?
Well, they feel dead.
Okay, just making sure.
Okay, yeah, continue. They explode their asses and die. So the bad bug is immobilized by the goo, and I think more sea explodens will then come and probably tear it limb from limb. Or if they don't do that, the animal coated with the goo will die later, most likely, since the goo is a chemical irritant. But to humans, the goo is harmless, and it apparently smells like curry. So there's like a dozen other types of exploding ants in the Colobopsis family that have been studied a little bit, and science has known about them since 1916. But for whatever reason, people didn't really like study them in a ton of detail until recently, it seems like. And sea explodens, which was officially named in 2018, was the first new species found since 1935. But people were really excited about it because these ants like to explode, not like to, tend to explode way more frequently than other exploding ants do. Like, I think a lot of exploding ants use it as like the last line of defense, but sea explodens just kind of like explode whenever. And if exploding butts weren't weird enough, there's a whole other hyper-specialized type of sea explodens ant. So the exploding guys are called minor workers, but there's also major workers. And major workers have huge heads that are pretty much shaped like corks. And when a sea explodens nest is attacked, the minor workers latch on to things and explode. But the major workers go to the entrances of the nests and they plug the holes up with their giant heads.
That's very cool. And I mean, we all understand that like these colonial insects aren't really individuals. They are out to protect genetic information in a very different way than we do. But the results of that keep being weirder the more I hear about colonial insects. And like, it's just, it's making it work. We're making like life makes life work. And sometimes it makes it work by blowing your butt up. Like, when is the first time? I guess you get like better and better at like being nearly exploded, because you gotta have like an evolutionary direction for that to go. And until you're so good at it, you can do it yourself. All right, Sari, you've got a pretty big deficit to overcome here.
I'll try and convince you with my passion for this food. So
I love food.
Yes, love food. Especially sticky rice, aka glutinous rice. Like it's delicious. Mm-hmm. I ate it a lot growing up because it's commonly used in East and South Asian cultures. So my mom made really good sticky rice, but it's also at like dim sum in various forms and mochi in Japan, which is becoming more popular in the US. I don't know. I'm trying to name like foods that a lot of people will have eaten. And it's called glutinous, not because it contains gluten, but because it's glue-like or sticky when cooked. And this is because the sugars in sticky rice are almost entirely amylopectin instead of amylose. So amylopectin is a highly branched molecule that is in starch, which contributes to its physical stickiness, and also the chemical structure makes it a little bit insoluble in water. And it's naturally in lots of waxy plant starches that are used as thickeners. But I'm not just talking about sticky rice as a delicious concept. It was also used in China around 500 CE as an innovative building material.
What?
Specifically, builders took an inorganic compound called calcium hydroxide, heated it up, and exposed it to water to make slaked lime. That was pretty standard, and one of several ways to prep lime mortar, which is a paste used to bind bricks or stones and seal the gaps between them.
Wow.
But at some point, someone was like, hey, let's mix in some sticky rice soup and see if it makes our mortar better. And thanks to amylopectin and the microstructures it formed with the calcium hydroxide, it had more strength and water resistance than the lime mortar. The sticky rice mortar was used in tombs, pagodas, and walls, including the Great Wall of China. And the proof is in the buildings, because some of these structures, like the Great Wall of China, are still standing today. And material scientists are even considering using sticky rice mortar as a restoration tool, because it's better than standard lime mortar for repairs, according to at least one set of experiments.
Wow.
So it's not something they use anymore? Or that
no,
use?
I think like modern building materials are better. Like we have other mixtures of mortars and a better understanding of chemistry. Mm-hmm. But back in the day, we were like, well, we know lime mortar is a thing. And then some people were like, let's add sticky rice.
Well,
to
rice
it
is
and
sticky.
Made it better. Yeah.
Let's try that. My true hope for all building materials is that there's something that we can find that's better than what we're using now, because what we're using now is both very good and also very impactful on the environment. And if we could do that with rice instead, that would be dope.
Yeah. And we can eat them. That would be another good goal for a building.
So, Sari, are you saying I can eat the Great Wall? Is that...
No, I think you'd still mostly taste brick. Like, the bricks are not made of it. You can maybe lick the, like, the little cracks between the bricks and maybe taste some sticky rice. I don't know.
Thank you for the advice.
Don't tell the officials that stop you.
Yeah. I'm going to the Great Wall. Everybody, all Tangents listeners, they go to the Great Wall and then... The police are like, what are you doing? And they said, Sari Riley said I could lick the cracks. Yeah. So I have to choose a winner. Should it be sticky rice used as a mortar in all kinds of building materials, including in the Great Wall of China? Or should it be that there is a kind of ant who can explode its own ass and coat its enemies with sticky goo? I'm sorry, Sari, but Sam came out in the lead on both of the games today.
Yeah.
And it's emerging victorious.
I needed this.
Which means it's time to ask the Science Couch, where we've got a listener question for our virtual couch of finely honed scientific minds. It's from @Paxadzinka, I think. How does a frog's tongue work?
Do you know this?
I don't.
Sam, do you know this?
No.
I don't know. You know what
I mean. Why would I know this?
Is it... Sari, are they sticky?
They are sticky.
Okay.
In multiple ways, in fact. I've linked the paper in the show notes. Okay. And I recommend, these scientists were great at writing. I love them. For example, one of the lines from it is, touching the frog tongue with a finger, as shown in figure 1D, indicates that the tongue is quite sticky, similar to marshmallow or chewing gum.
Oh.
So descriptive. This is all I wanted to know about frogs' tongues. Thank you, scientists, for doing this. And so it's sticky for two different reasons. One, frog tongues, apparently, are one of the softest biological materials known. They're about 10 times softer than a human tongue. And they're just like these pillowy structures. So they can like bounce back and forth. They can work like a bungee cord. That's why they like fling out. Mm-hmm. And they can also deform around their prey. So like they're so soft that kind of like when you smoosh your head into like a really soft pillow, their tongue smooshes around the bug and like envelops it in flesh.
So bugs are experiencing almost the softest thing they possibly could right before their death.
It probably feels kind of hard in the way that when you like
hit
someone with a pillow in a pillow fight, it hits at a very high velocity. But for a moment, they might be really comfy in between the pain. And then secondly, the saliva, which is also quite thick, and it changes its viscosity. So it's considered a non-Newtonian fluid, which we defined in one of our bonus episodes kind of haphazardly.
And I'm going to define it haphazardly now, which is just basically a fluid that doesn't behave according to like regular physical laws. When it hits the prey, the saliva flows. It's like really flowy and seeps into the crevices of the prey. But then as its tongue pulls back, then the mucus molecules and the saliva solidify, basically, and make it really easy for the frog to pull it back. So there's a lot of grip when its tongue is retracting. And then it flows again when the frog swallows. So there are moments where it is acting like a liquid, and mm-hmm. there are moments when it is like really, really grippy.
Wow. That's what you want if you're a frog tongue. How do I touch a frog tongue? I'm curious now. I want to touch this very soft thing.
Gotta go back to college, I guess. Learn about frogs more. Be a frog scientist.
Get a job at a frog lab.
The only way. Yeah.
If you want to ask the Science Couch your question, you can follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we'll tweet out the topics for upcoming episodes every week. Thank you to @Jeffro.VT, @HolyN, and everybody else who tweeted us your questions for this episode. If you like this show and you want to help us out, there's several ways you can do that. You can become a patron at patreon.com/SciShowTangents. You can get access to things like our newsletters and our bonus episodes, where we go deeper on a bunch of questions and take questions from patrons. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That helps us know what you like about the show. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Caitlin Hoffmeister and Sam Schultz, who edits a lot of these episodes. Our social media organizer is Paola Garcia Prieto. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish, and we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you, and remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. Pygmy squids live in seagrass, where they use an adhesive patch on the back of their body to stick themselves to seagrass blades. This feature has led some scientists to call them the sucker bum squid.
Cool. Oh. It's too bad we didn't get to evolve suckers. What I want is to be able to like hold my, just like stick my coffee to my arm and not have to, like, so I can free up my hands to do something else. That sounds very dangerous.
That's not the best application.
I'm definitely going to spill that on me.